the riot that ensued, and where would you like to pick it up now? You
well,
said that you were coming or going to the stadium with your meal tickets for the men.
I'd gone there to, we'd finished there issuing out the mail, the men was up there and they're coming up there in Virginia. And when we told them, they said, it's no good going up to the meeting because we're not supposed to be there. So back down here to the center of town. And if there's going to be any action, it should be down there. There's no good fighting here, police or meeting police right here on there. So then the Central Strike Committee got together, as we got down here against the theatre district in Regina, and they said, look, we can't have any troubles or anything like that, not in Regina. We'll line up and we'll march back here to the stadium. Well, they lined up, four deep, and the division was moving back down to the stadium.
The same as you had done in Vancouver?
Just the same. Just the same when we left here the Senator. All went back into divisions. And just on the march, got about one block down, and right at the back on us, down comes the Mounties riding full tilt. So that was it. They broke us all up, and we flew in all directions, some on us into stores, some on us through plate glass windows, some of us here up on top of buildings, climbed the fire escapes, anywhere to get away here from these clubs and horses. But we had nothing in our hands to battle them. And when we come down and started to surge again into the middle of the town where we'd been scattered, we found a bunch of citizens that got rocks or stones from their own garden or something and bought them, and they handed it to us right on the street. During that time, we pushed cars across the street on the angle, a purpose to stop any more horses from kind of galloping down through there without we could take care of them ourselves. Because we wasn't going to be rode down with a bunch of police with clubs and guns.
The horses have always been trained with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to attack people, to trample over there.
Trample them down. So, knowing this and knowing what happened up here in BC at different times, our cars and stuff went across there. And Gardner and Attorney General Davis come along the street, and they stopped, and this is, we were stopping all traffic from coming across and getting in the way of the mounties coming through, because we didn't want to see anybody in the citizens getting hurt in their car. That's why we stopped here, Attorney General Davis and Gardner. And when we seen who it was, I'm on the sideboard explaining to them that they're lucky to get hurt, and they speeded up the car, and I was going straight up to the barracks. But as that happened, another car come across the way, two blocks further up, and he had to slow down. So I dropped off and come back downtown.
Did he not believe you?
Oh, I think he believed me, but not the driver. He had the order to go.
Because as I remember from the telegrams, he certainly was aware that he wasn't in charge of the police.
Oh, definitely. He knew that when Art and the Central Committee went to meet Gardner and Attorney General Davis, it was stated right there that if you don't bring here the Mounties here under your control, you're going to have blood here all over the streets of Regina. It was told him at that time.
I'd like you to explain that, because I wouldn't like anyone who listens to this tape to feel that that was a threat from my father or the strike committee, that you were going to cause the bloodshed, but that it was the reverse, that if they were under the control of the federal government, that's exactly what the orders were going to be.
Gardner stated to us when we told him what was going to happen with all these police being brought up here, it's only for one person, for one purpose, and that was for a bloodbath here in Regina. And the police would create it. That's what they're there for to do, and they will do it. We wanted Gardner to take full control, and Gardner and Attorney General Davis, it was Gardner who made the statement, I cannot do nothing. And this was in the government office. I can do nothing until it happens. Then, if they do create a blood bar in the streets of Regina, then I can take here action and do something against the mounted police by taking them out.
And did he do that?
No, he did later. Before the trains come to move, for moving the down, that was all done by Gardner and Attorney General Davis. But he didn't move until that action took place here of the riot with the...
We have a political pull. We have Gardner as a liberal and we have Bennett as a conservative. Do you feel he was an honest man who had concern for your plight, or was it a political move that he was willing to disagree with Bennett? What would be
a political move or a purpose to get... you see, there's not very much a difference between the conservative and the liberal. He wanted power, and if he could get more power by having more elected heir into Ottawa, well, by having King in them, Gardner was no different here as a King. And we know what King done. He never gave us no 50 cents an hour after Bennett was burst. So it's just a pause here to...
I'm only trying to find out whether this was a man who was sympathetic to your plight, or was this a politician?
A politician. They talk sympathetic in that way, but then that is a politician. But he got no intentions, the same as Gandhi in India. He says, well, lay down in the street, let them ride over you, and things will be done for you. Well, the bees rode over lots of them, shot lots of them, and murdered lots of them. Nothing was done for India. Finally, they had to get rid of the whole shebang.
But that would be the last thing my father would suggest to a man, is to lay down and let somebody trample over you.
Well, that was going to be far from a Gandhi, and he had thousands more with him, not thousands, but hundreds more with him, as wasn't going to lay down here and be no Gandhi.
A man has the right to walk upright on the face of this earth.
Especially when you're born in this country.
Yeah.
And you don't want no British coming over, trying to overrun your country, but to help you run it, not to take over and run it their way. Because they couldn't even run Britain, so how would they expect you to run here Canada?
I would like to ask you, to your recollections, people obviously were injured, there was one death, there were machine guns. Do you know of some of the charges, other than Section 98, that were laid against the strikers?
No, because I was too busy in getting the trains ready, getting all the material and the stuff ready here from Gardner and Attorney General Davis, for getting the guys back. I was more or less working on my own between them, with the committee, the strike committee, operating to keep the divisions active, and whatever they'd got to do while we was waiting around for that. So,
prior to your having been chosen to be in charge of the food, you were a division captain, were you?
No, before that, yes.
Yeah.
I was.
And of which division?
Division 1.
And how many men would you have had in that division?
Well, we set each one of those divisions up for 300.
Mm-hmm.
Each hall was set up for 300. And set in Division 5, and that while we was in Vancouver, Division 5 was acting as a pickup division, and people coming in and out. They could have been 400, 600. We never knew how many there was in Division 5. It was growing and
captain. Sorry, how did people become division captains, executive of the relief camp workers?
All elected here straight from the rank and file in the first meeting as we have in the hall.
Then we're talking once again of good trade union philosophy.
The tops. And it was followed through right to the last of any reactions in the camps. That was always followed right the way through.
And I'd like to ask you one more question. I've heard that my father was quite a hard taskmaster. How was he able to get the tremendous work, the tremendous support from the executive? How did this come about? Were you all well trained? Just what was it that made this such a tremendous organization? And I don't mean from my father's point of view. What made you people willing to do this work, which was over and above what you might have had to have done if you just wanted to go along?
Well, anybody who's moved in, knew anything about organization in the first place. Anybody who's moved in and seen what was happening, and especially when they went up against art, we were always hungry. We were always looking for something to eat. Now, he could tell us how to go about it and get it. Either by the cans or going out to the camps and staying in the camps and organizing out there. But he always had the other ways and means of showing you how this had got to be done and the organizing. He honestly got that, same as what Alan Luxmore had it, from being active in mining camps, because they're always organized.
The miner is the hardest man, the hardest, I mean, with steel in his heart and his bones of any man in this world who works for a living. He's had to be.
And he's not going to lay down to the last one and start today. Never. Not in any country in this capitalist world. Is a miner going to lay down here and just starve? He's never going to be a dandy. He's never just going to lay down on the street. He's going to put up a fight regardless, because he knows that there's, while he can dig here the materials out of the earth, other people can be growing the goods to feed.
Of course, the miner also lives with death even today, let alone 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. Mines are not the safest places in the world, and the diseases you get makes a man realize that death is right next door, and death really isn't a thing to be afraid of. It is, because we'd all like to live, but when you live with it, you're not that frightened to be a man.
I don't think you'll ever find it in any other industry but mining. You go into a shoe shop. Well, you go in at 7 o'clock in the morning, or 8 o'clock, whatever it is, you do your 8 hours, you come out, and you forget it. Your next door neighbor, or the guy who's working, you might not even remember his name a week later if he happened to quit. But a miner is different. You go down in the mine here with a bunch of men, and you get talking here of this, and what the conditions of a miner, what the ground is like, and if you're not talking that all the time, you'll never know, or wouldn't know, whether the ground was strong, weak, or what was going to happen to that mine. So, every one of you is looking after the next guy next to you. And not only just for that shift, but all times. You depend on that mate. You become his closer than a brother. So, in mining, there's something here and there that is different, altogether different, to any other industries you go into. Other industries, you go to work, you go away from the job, and if the guy got fired here that day, or got laid off, or was sick, you just go the next day and start working. But in a mine, when you go to work the next day, if your mate is not there, you don't go to work until you find out what's happened to him, or where he is, or what's doing.
And this is the history that goes back a long time.
Long,
not just 20 years ago. This goes
hundreds
back
of years.
Hundreds of years.
And that's how close they lived together. That's why you can always have, when a miner decides he's going to go out on strike for something else's increase or better for his standard of living, it's going to be a fight right to the last.
A mine might not be a good job, but your experience and learning about people obviously has to be a great influence on your life.
And that's where art was right on top of everything. He'd seen all these things for years and years building up, and he knew what was going to take place. You didn't have to tell Art Evans, oh, well, there's a war coming along, Art, in 1939. He knew that they were building up the war long before it ever happened, and he certainly knew what you've got to do about it if you were going to stake those things off. But as one individual, he couldn't do those things himself. He'd got to talk, act, and be a man himself, opposed to show all the younger people that that's the way you've got to be if you're going to have any influence on other people around you.
Yes, I think we all believe exemplary is a very good thing for our children and the people we work with. There is one other area, Perry, I would like to touch. You happen to have belonged to a very illustrious group that even after the unemployed movement was hopefully finished for that period, that my father still had some contact with you, and that was when you went to Spain. Could you tell me approximately how many of the Ottawa Trekkers did go to Spain?
No, but I think here Bob Savage, or he was organizer for the Spanish group. Bob Kerr should be. Perhaps Red Walsh would know. But Kerr should have the other figures to his tip. But I would imagine Spain itself from Vancouver, or if I was to guess, about 300. 300 to 600.
Could you tell me why did you go to Spain? I know, but I would like you to tell me why.
Well, my views, and I think it goes with every, with 90% of the others. We see that we couldn't do very much else here in BC or in Canada. And there was a government elected in Spain, and if we wanted to show the people in Vancouver that we was sincere as working class people, and things as was happening, there's only one way as we could prove ourselves is to go and give the idea to the Spanish people as elected that government. In fact, even today, I would say the same thing. If we had the same group and had the chance to go down here and defend here the people of Chile, we would do so. But as far as Chile is concerned, it's out of our range today. But at that time in Spain, knowing that the people had suffered here to the extent of what they had done through the starvation, the same thing of what we were going through in Canada, we decided if it was at all possible to get to Spain and help to defend that democracy, we were going to do it.
Then it was a continuing development of your personalities, and one rose from one association, and obviously that the things you went through with your unemployed and
what you learn about the question in the unemployed movement and the actions you had to take, it's only a step from there to understanding the situation in Spain, and from Spain it's only a step from there to understanding what happened in 1939, the beginning of the war, when we said it was a phony war. It was a phony war.
Was there discrimination in the trap? Did you have people other than the white, Caucasian, Anglo-Saxon? I know you had a few communists. I don't know what other than Reds they call them. But did you have ethnic groups? Did you have Oriental groups?
We had as much of a mixture as what you've got in the city of Vancouver today, in the Spanish issue.
And also
and,
in the armed part of our trek issue?
And yeah, same thing.
Then you did believe in the fundamental good of man, whether he spoke your language, whether he was the same color, that you all had the same worship in earth?
No, I didn't. I never even give that a thought at all, because in Spain, especially, the best comrades I ever had has come out now out to get me out of two or three scraps. Two colored guys. One was you know the guys this was up on charge down south, and I think there was seven of them or five of them. It was up on charge, and the rape or something of a white woman in a train, and then she had to come forward here and explain that she was told to say that and do that because of the police down here in the south. I think it was a bunch of brothers. I won't be sure about that. But anyway, one of these, Jackson, I believe his name was, he was here in the prison with me in Spain. And before that, he was my driver here for the kitchen, for between the battalion and the kitchen. And you couldn't wish for a better guy and a better comrade than him.
He used comrade as a general expression, or as the full meaning of the word?
Oh, no, only certain individuals.
Perry, I have enjoyed meeting you and getting to know you, and before we sign off, I would like, really, once more you to tell me, you have said that my father knew his business as an organizer, he knew his business as a miner. We're still talking about a great deal of men who really and truly laid their lives down on the line, because my God, they had all of the government of Canada against them. What do you think was it the desperate, just going nowhere, doing nothing, what made them accept my father? And he certainly was called Red. He was in every manner that the newspapers could tear him apart. In fact, even some of our left-wing so-called politicians in British Columbia called him a coward, such as Mr. Winch. He ran into
Mr. Winch? Huh. Gosh. That's a laugh.
Well, would you like to tell me something about him?
Well, I met both Winches. But Harold, he was nothing like his dad. His dad did have enough gumption about him, did understand enough. I met him up here in, when we was organizing up at Rupert, and I happened to ask his dad, old man Winch, I says, well, when they come and throw you out of the halls, or when they take action against you with the clubs and the bullets, the same as they did in Regina, what are you going to do, Mr. Winch? He was wise enough to say then, you'll call on the Communist Party. Well, young Winch, our Winch, he wouldn't have enough savvy to tell you that. Because Errol Winch was just here riding on the back of the old man, and he certainly exploited here Burnaby for everything he had in him as far as a living standard. And it's been a good living standard for Errol Winch.
Did it bother the majority of the men that my father was a communist?
No. In fact, if you ask your dad here, not to be a communist, he wouldn't have took no notice on him, no more than what we took a Winch. He'd have been another person. Let's get away here from the idea of communists as something that goes running around, same as he used to tell us when the Russian Revolution was on in Britain. They all carry knives here in the mouth, they've got knives down here, the sides, they've got guns here, and all they're going to do is to kill and slaughter people. That is just the reverse. There's your fascists, right there. You're not going to get a communist at any time. In fact, I've never seen one, or ever heard of one, as he's going to be carrying guns, knives, and stuff like that. Unless he's in a war area.
I ever knew my father's fight was verbally and mentally.
That's about all you would get it done. Because he fought all right. He fought on the right line. Organized the unorganized, get the people together, and as long as the workers organize and talk things over themselves, they don't need guns, they don't need air weapons of that description at all. That book and that understanding of the working class can walk through any door, any steel bars, or anything. They don't have to worry about it as long as that worker is fully organized. But until we all get organized, we've got to take the bats from the police, from the provincial police, the Minion, and the rest of them, and even the so-called Arrow Winches, who's never done nothing as far as I'm concerned.
But you did have very young boys, so you had young men on the track who obviously hadn't lived very long. They would have been in their early 20s, perhaps even in their teens. Did the Red Bogey upset them? Were they able to, you know, often age helps understanding, but were these young people, did the Red Bogey, which they laid on my father and some of the others, bother them?
I'll try and give you one illustration, Matt. Your dad's up on a platform, and they're given the line of what we should do. Stay back, let this committee go down to Ottawa, and your dad didn't say we're going to Ottawa. He left it strictly to us, the rank and file, to decide whether they should go to Ottawa and talk to the government or what we was going to do from then on. But when he laid down here the point of that's what we could do, is to send a delegation, he said, no, it's up to you to decide. That's all. Not just the strike committee, but everybody was in that meeting. And there was all the divisions. What you wanted to do. Now, how much higher can you get than that? I wish the capitalists would take that, because then they wouldn't be capitalists. They took that attitude and did those things that way. So, we decided ourselves that we would stay in Regina. But not me. I was an individual. Now, I stated when your dad was saying here about him sending a delegation down there and leaving it up here to the rank and file, I was the one who said here, right here from amongst the rank and file, no, on to Ottawa. Let us get to Ottawa. Well, your dad and them knew a little bit more about the thing than what I did. And they put it up to a vote again to the rest of the guys. Well, when I got the drift of what was going to happen between Winnipeg and Regina, that the Mounties was all gathered there here to take action, I said, well, it's better to stay right in Regina. So away went the committee. But any time as I had an idea, I always looked for your dad to give us here a clear understanding what was going to happen, and he did at that time. So that's why I backed down. I said, well, we're staying in Ottawa until the guys go here to Ottawa and come back here with the message.
Well,
but never a time did your dad ever, as I ever heard or ever known, that he said, we're going to Ottawa, we're going to fight our way through to Ottawa, or Then the riot was on that we should stand and fight. I might have said we should stand and fight, which I did, but not your dad. From him, that's why I say he was a good organizer. I was a bum organizer, but he was a good organizer because he said, look, we avoid trouble wherever we can. And there was instances when it should have been avoided, where I wouldn't have walked away from it completely. I did, because he said we should. But if it had been left strictly to myself, no, I wouldn't have walked away from it. But he proved it to me. That was the policy.
Well, I want to thank you very much for the interview, Perry, and may I have permission to use the material on this tape for Dad's biography?
You sure can, Gene, because anything that will pay out in the a worker's cause, whatever it is, as long as it's used the right way, fine and dandy.
Well, let's hope that it will be good information for another generation if they need
I'm saying this. I couldn't possibly tell you of all the good as your dad done while we was in Bangor. I couldn't possibly start to think about it. You might get it from all the different ones around, but I doubt if you would still get the full benefit of what he done as far as helping us guys through and doing.
Well, he happened to believe that man should walk straight and have the benefits of the whole world.
If one individual should have lived to have seen this come into action, because, although I don't know, he might have thrown his hand up.
No. We'll hope that history will always find someone to lead.
Yeah.